Good afternoon. You're listening to KFSK Public Radio in Petersburg. It's Midday Magazine for Monday, the 1st of March, 2021. I'm Joe Vicnicki with the local news. Petersburg remained at 62 total active cases of COVID-19 yesterday, with the number of new cases in the community's outbreak slowing a little over the weekend. Petersburg's Emergency Operations Center reported just one new case Saturday and five on Sunday, but also listed six people as recovered. Since February 18th, Petersburg's EOC has reported 70 new cases. Four of those are outside of Petersburg. Eight of those cases are considered recovered. Positive cases have been directed to isolate, and state contact tracers are investigating close contacts in the community. State Public Health Nurse Aaron Michael says the state was able to marshal its forces to focus on Petersburg.
A lot of other places across the state are not as active as we are with cases. And so we've got multiple teams working on Petersburg right now that are helping out.
On Friday, she said the outbreak hasn't been traced to any single event, but she says it's been widespread.
Young kids all the way up to people in their 80s and everywhere in between. It is an equal opportunity infection.
And that was echoed by Petersburg's hospital CEO, Phil Hofstetter.
We're seeing cases all over the place, less than a year old, all the way up into the 80s. It's all over the map.
Petersburg School District switched to distance learning February 23rd, and kids aren't expected to return to the classroom until next week at the earliest. Superintendent Erica Klute-Painter says there are several cases connected to the district. She says multiple classrooms have been impacted, especially in the elementary school, which has been somewhat surprising.
I think we all were a little more hopeful about sort of the younger kids maybe not being quite as impacted in that sense, but So the elementary's been hit pretty hard that way, but we do have those connections and a few in the secondary schools as well.
She says they are not pointing fingers or blaming anyone because the outbreak is so widespread. She's asking residents to hunker down over the next week to help bring that case count down. A reminder, people with symptoms can call the COVID hotline. That phone number is 772-5788. Also, asymptomatic testing continues at the airport this week, Monday through Friday from 7:30 to 10 a.m. An individual traveling with the Haynes High School basketball teams tested positive for COVID-19 before departing for a series of away games last week, but the results of the test came back after the girls and boys teams competed in Craig last Tuesday and Wednesday. Henry Alicia has more on that story from Haynes.
An individual traveling with Haynes High School basketball teams tested positive for COVID-19 before departing for a series of away games earlier this week. The results of the test came after the girls and boys teams competed in Craig on Tuesday and Wednesday. The Haynes Glacier Bears were scheduled to travel to Craig and then on to Wrangell this week for a series of basketball games. Haynes School Superintendent Roy Getchell says that everyone making the trip was tested for COVID-19 on Monday before getting on the ferry and heading out of town.
We have a weekly testing protocol, and this was our fourth Monday to do this. And so we do that as a mitigation, you know, for activities and for travel also. So we test every Monday. So the tests occur at that time, and then the results come back whenever they're processed.
Getchell says the basketball teams competed in Craig on Tuesday and Wednesday. After that, they were scheduled to play in Wrangell, but those games were canceled after an active case of COVID-19 was identified in that community. Then, on Thursday, Getchell was notified that the results of a test for one of the individuals traveling with the Haynes basketball teams came back positive.
This did not occur because of travel, but it was identified because of our travel protocol. If we had not tested and we weren't doing that on a weekly basis, this could have gone undetected, and we hadn't traveled yet.
Getchell wouldn't say if the individual was a student or not. State public health officials completed a contact tracing investigation and notified all close contacts. According to Craig City School Superintendent Chris Raytan, officials did not find that any of the school's athletes, staff, or community members had direct contact with the person from Haynes who tested positive. Craig High School switched to distance learning on Friday to allow the district to sanitize the building and determine if any students or staff members develop COVID-19 symptoms. Getchell, the Haines school superintendent, says the student athletes and others who were on the trip returned to Haines by chartered plane Friday afternoon. The close contacts of the individual who tested positive will quarantine upon arrival. The Haines school continued with in-person classes on Friday. Getchell says public health officials and the school's health advisory committee determined it was not necessary to close the building.
Luckily, there was not any contact with the school during the contagious period. So we're, you know, the people who've been identified to quarantine are already not in the school. So that's why that decision was made.
Getchell says school staff will receive a regularly scheduled COVID-19 test on Tuesday. Close contacts of the individual who tested positive will also be tested later in the week. In Haines, I'm Henry Leisha.
The state's health department is rolling out a new program designed to get millions of dollars in federal funds to combat COVID-19 directly to boroughs and communities. Applications for the first round of $37.5 million must be made to the Department of Health and Social Services in the next 2.5 weeks.
I know this has been a really quick turnaround time, but again, we've been trying to get this together as quickly as possible and get it out to the communities as quickly as possible.
That's Maria Caruso coordinating the new program for the health department. The money is supposed to be used to help with COVID-19 testing and administering of vaccines. And each grant comes with a health equity requirement. That means at least 10% has to go towards activities that address obstacles to health like poverty or discrimination. Caruso's and others at the health department encourage borough and city government leaders to team up with local nonprofits and other community organizations to get the funds spread out equitably among residents.
Let's say you have a goal of advancing equitable vaccine distribution among the Alaska Pacific Islander community. That might look like a local government giving funds to the Polynesian Association of Alaska, which will allow them to work with trusted community leaders on community education and outreach efforts on the vaccine.
There's a cap on how much funding is available for each city or borough based on population size. That means the city of Anchorage can get more than $13 million, while Lyme Village near Bethel can apply for less than $650. Local governments will have to pay for the expenses up front and then invoice the state for reimbursement. And applications for that program due to the state by March 15th. A cross-border watershed monitoring program has wrapped up with Alaska and British Columbia regulators concluding that the project has run its course. As Coast Alaska's Jacob Resnick reports, tribes and scientists say there's still work to be done.
The Taku, Stikine, and Yunak are significant salmon-producing rivers. These fisheries are a key subsistence food source for Southeast Alaskans, and they're prized for the cash value for commercial and charter fleets. In 2015, Governor Walker signed a landmark agreement with British Columbia, pledging to study and monitor these transboundary watersheds that host a booming Canadian mining sector and Alaska's fisheries. That monitoring effort didn't get off the ground until 2017, and now Alaska and BC governments say their work is done. Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation project manager Terry Lomax says the state developed valuable partnerships with British Columbia, but now there are other entities doing the monitoring, including the U.S. Geological Service.
So we did not want to be duplicative and want to truly just be efficient with all the resources. Didn't feel like it was necessary for multiple agencies to be collecting the same thing.
And it's the same story on the other side of the border, too. Greg Tamblyn heads BC's Environment Ministry's Regional Water Quality Section in Smithers.
Because these established sampling programs in the region, continuation of the joint sampling program would really be redundant.
Their final report says that 2 years of data found that water quality standards weren't exceeded on Alaska's side of the border. It found times when certain heavy metals were over limits in sediment, but noted there's a lot of naturally occurring minerals in the region. But scientists who've studied these watersheds say a couple of years is a blink of an eye for dynamic river systems.
You can't measure a given site once or twice a year for 2 years and claim that you know the baseline watershed health of that area.
Chris Sargent is a freshwater ecologist with the University of Montana's Flathead Lake Biological Station. The final report noted there was little evidence of contamination and aquatic life appeared healthy. But Sargent says many of the mines that Alaskans downstream are worried about haven't been built yet.
You know,
way I look at this is we have a lot of potential mines coming down the pike that are very large projects that could be built in the near future. And so I'm looking at like, well, do we know what these metal patterns look like right now in these rivers in case those big projects are built and things change? And I just don't think we're set up for success to answer that question yet.
It was Southeast Alaska tribes that helped spur the Walker administration to engage BC over transboundary mining. And they say the work has been short-lived. Fred Olson Jr. heads the 15-tribe Southeast Alaska Indigenous Transboundary Commission.
We definitely need water quality sampling, but we need ongoing, seasonal, sustainable sampling. We don't need a couple years of hit and miss, cherry-picking the data, and then saying everything's okay.
But Alaska and BC will still collaborate. Its bilateral working group, established during the Walker administration, will continue to meet twice a year. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Jacob Resnick.
A dime-sized fragment of dog bone, more than 10,000 years old, has given researchers new clues about how domesticated dogs first made their way into the Americas. Sage Smiley has more on that story from Wrangell.
Examining a pinto bean-sized bone fragment, the scientist thought she was analyzing an ancient bear bone.
We have a sort of a long-standing project working on bear bones from these caves.
Charlotte Lundquist is an associate professor of biology at the State University of New York at Buffalo. Caves dot all over the Alexander Archipelago in southeast Alaska. The fragment of leg bone came from a cave on the mainland, just east of Wrangell Island. The cave is a marble tube about the length of a standard swimming pool.
And this DNA, when we were looking at it and analyzing it, we realized this is not bear DNA.
Lundquist and her colleagues realized the bone was from a dog and published their findings in a scientific journal in February. Turns out the dog lived around 10,000 years ago.
That is among the oldest dog remains that we have from North America.
Ancient dog remains are a rare discovery on their own, but Lundquist explains that the location is also part of what makes this identification so exciting. To understand why, we need to look back to the Ice Age, which ended about 10,000 years ago.
During the Ice Age, pretty much most of North America was completely covered in these two big ice sheets. So pretty much there was no contact north and south of the ice sheet.
Basically, a band of ice across Canada and the northern United States prevented the people living in northern Beringia, what is now Alaska, from moving south into what's now the lower 48.
There has been this long-standing hypothesis that as soon as these two ice sheets started melting, it opened up sort of a continental inland corridor. I mean, if you've seen the Disney movie, right, Ice Age, that's sort of what is displayed in that movie there. But more and more we start to believe that the coast probably started melting earlier and became viable earlier than this inland corridor.
And as the adage goes, a dog is a man's best friend.
Finding a dog on the coast can also tell us a lot about not just the migration and where dogs have been, but then of course also humans, because the dogs, they followed the humans and were alongside humans.
Human remains and tools from various points in ancient history have been found in the same cave off Wrangell Island. The dog bone was collected in the late 1990s by a now-retired earth science professor at the University of South Dakota, Timothy Heaton.
Back in the late 90s and early 2000s, he did multiple trips and excavated bones from a number of caves in southeast Alaska.
The 50,000-odd bones now reside in the collections of the Museum of the North in Fairbanks. The piece of dog femur may be tiny, but it could yield Lundquist a lot of information.
For now, we have just isolated the DNA from the mitochondrion in this bone, and that is inherited from the mother, so it only tells us actually the maternal history of this dog. So if we can, from this tiny little bone that we have left, get some nuclear DNA, DNA from the genome, we might be able to get more deeper insights into the history of this particular dog and the history of New World dogs.
She says she hopes for other discoveries in the thousands of bones from southeast Alaska caves that are left to analyze.
I'm sure it's not the last, and it will be exciting as we hopefully will find the older remains as well.
The cave off Wrangell Island has only been partially excavated. That's because it's a heritage site protected by federal law. Human remains from the site have been repatriated to Wrangell's Tlingit tribe, the Wrangell Cooperative Association, under the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act. In Wrangell, I'm Sage Smiley.
And for KFSK News, I'm Joe Bicknicki.